for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. The Senate resumes work this week on deficit negotiations. The administration and congressional Democrats have agreed to a series of spending cuts, but remain at loggerheads with Republicans over whether measures that would raise government revenues can be included. Joining me to talk about what's at stake for both parties and the country, David Wessel. He's economics editor for The Wall Street Journal. Alexis Simmendinger, she's White House correspondent for Real Clear Politics. And Chris Saliza, author of The Fix, that's a Washington Post politics blog, and managing editor of postpolitics.com. I look forward to hearing your thoughts on this ongoing wrangle. Give us a call on 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Join us on Facebook or send us a tweet. Good morning to all of you.
Good morning, Diane.
How frustrated are you, Chris Saliza, with this ongoing problem?
Well, I try to be a sunny optimist, and we're just coming off of a 3-day nice long weekend. So let's not be too cynical on a Tuesday, nice Tuesday morning in Washington. But yeah, look, we have known this for a long time, Diane. The simple fact is the government as it is currently structured in Washington is basically not working right. The American people sense this. You look at any poll, the institutions, Congress is broadly unpopular. People think the country is headed off in the wrong direction. They don't particularly like either party. They don't particularly like the president of the United States, though he's slightly more popular than Congress is, certainly. Everyone knows what the problems are, which is this government, the way we've set up politics at least, is not a way in which you should set them up if you want to solve big problems. We talk about grand bargains. We talk about both sides making compromises, when in fact, you know, listen to John McCain, the 2008 presidential nominee and senator from Arizona on Sunday. He essentially said the 2010 elections, which Republicans won many seats, affirmed that Republicans on this matter, on the budget, on tax increases, on spending cuts, do not want compromise. So, you know, we're in some ways back to square one, and, you know, we're looking at a July 22nd or August 2nd, depending on how you define this deadline for us defaulting on our loans. So we're up against it.
So up against it, David Wessel, where do we go from here? You did have John McCain, John Cornyn, over the weekend say that they would be willing to compromise just a little bit. What were the compromises? How far might they take us?
Well, look, I think it's like union negotiations, and we're down to the wire. And whether Chris is right about the dysfunction of our government or not, we've been at junctures like this before where only a deadline forces the Congress to move off their preferred positions to something that's second best. And so we're going to see a couple weeks of seeing how far they'll move. What Senator Cornyn and Senator McCain are saying, I think, is very hard for ordinary people to understand. They're against tax increases, but they're okay with revenue increases, which is a little hard to understand when it's the same money flowing out of your wallet.
But explain.
So what the Republicans are digging in their heels about is they do not want to raise the tax rates, the marginal tax rate, the rate on which you pay the government for each additional dollar of income. And the president campaigned on raising tax rates for upper-income people. And the Republicans are saying, we won't do that. But Senator McCain, Senator Cornyn, a number of other Republicans who are part of this so-called Gang of Six in the Senate have said, okay, we don't want to raise tax rates, but there may be other ways in which we can raise revenue by doing away with tax credits, exemptions, or deductions. And the eventual compromise, if there is one, will involve this. The loggerheads they're at right now is the Republicans have said, we've got the Democrats to agree to about $1 trillion worth of spending cuts. why should we have to compromise now on revenues? And the Democrats are saying, we've agreed to $1 trillion worth of spending cuts. We're not going to keep bargaining over spending cuts unless you guys are willing to put revenue on the table.
So how far apart are the two sides?
Seems about $400 billion over 10 years. The president has signaled that he will go along with this deficit reduction agreement with about $1 trillion worth of spending cuts over a decade if the Republicans agree to about $400 billion worth of revenue increases over that same period.
And, Alexis, how important or how artificial is this deadline? First August, second now, July 22nd.
Well, I think it's real. You know, there isn't any economist or Treasury official who is trying to suggest that there are tons more tools in the kit bag at Treasury to rejigger accounts, which they've been doing for months now. They talked about doing this after May, and that, you know, this is how we got to the August 2nd deadline, which is rejiggering accounts. So Treasury is saying, this is it. This is it, boys and girls. We're not going to be able to stretch this farther. And then when you walk back from the August 2nd date, you say in Washington, let's say there's a framework deal. How long does it take to write the legislative language? How long does it take for the Congressional Budget Office to score it so that all of the lawmakers agree to what the effect that they want? And then how long will it take to get through two chambers, the House and the Senate, and then go to the president? So that's how the White House is saying, look, after mid-July, July 22nd, we're really hitting the skids here. So they're trying to signal we don't have that many weeks left. And they've been saying that since May, but they're saying we're really down to it.
Alexis Semendinger, she's White House correspondent for Real Clear Politics. Do join us, 800-433-8850. And now, is it true, David Wessel, that some congressional Republicans are saying they won't act on raising the debt limit without holding votes in House and Senate on a balanced budget amendment for the Constitution?
Well, it's true that some of them are saying that, and it wouldn't be all that hard to put up a balanced budget amendment as long as it doesn't pass. But look, I think what the difficulty here is there is no agreement possible that all the Republicans will support or that all the Democrats will support. There is no agreement that can get through Congress with only Republican or only Democratic votes. So there will be people on the left and the right who vote against whatever there is. And what this is about is finding something that gets enough Republicans and enough Democrats to support so it can get through Congress.
How many are we talking about,
well,
Chris?
Well, you know, Diane, I think, first of all, David's point is exactly the right one. And I think that's what makes it difficult for John Boehner and Mitch McConnell, frankly, to bargain, you know, craft such so-called grand bargain.
Because?
Well, look at the House. Let's take the House, for example. We saw 80-plus new freshmen elected in 2010, one of the largest classes in history. Many of them beat incumbent Democrats, but many of them won open seats in conservative places as well. Lots and lots of those people took a pledge to never raise taxes. The infamous Grover Norquist, Americans for Tax Reform pledge. 230 House members, mostly Republicans, not all, but 230 House members have signed that pledge, which is no tax increases, no revenue increases at all. The question for John Boehner is, let's say he signs off on a deal with President Obama that's something like David outlined. Will his conference vote for it? And can he, as the leader of the Republican Party in the House, survive a compromise that is passed not with a majority Republican votes, but a majority Democratic votes, that he gets a certain number, 75, 80 Republicans and a bunch of Democrats? That's what I think his nightmare scenario is, what he doesn't want to do. Of course, you know, when you play a game of chicken, there's always the chance that neither of you swerve the car. I still don't think that's the likely outcome because the blame game is too uncertain. Any poll suggests people blame both sides equally. Neither one, and I say both sides, President Obama and congressional Republicans, I don't think either one want that. But in some ways, it's the immovable force and the inanimate object at the moment.
David Wessel, explain the revenue generators the Democrats are calling for. Give us a sense of those. And would you, in fact, call them tax hikes?
I would call them tax hikes. We're playing a name game in Washington now, and this will be like one of those peace negotiations where each side declares victory but defines victory differently. What they're talking about, the president has made a big deal about some relatively small corporate tax breaks for corporate jets, for oil and gas drilling, for the way businesses account for inventories. If you take away those breaks, those companies will pay more taxes. On the individual side, he's talking about changing the way deductions and credits are calculated. If you're an upper income taxpayer, you get for every dollar you get to deduct, you save 35 cents on taxes. If you're a lower income taxpayer, you only get to save 15 cents on your taxes. So he's got a scheme. He proposed it in his budget that would make it more even in his view. This would be a tax increase in my book, but so be it.
And how much of a dent would they make in what's left to be negotiated?
I think now it's become largely symbolic. The president has thrown in the towel. It's not going to be 50% tax increases and 50% spending cuts. It's going to be relatively small share of tax increases, but he needs to get some tax increases to show his Democratic base that he won something as negotiations. Otherwise, the whole thing will be a tax spending, Medicare, Medicaid, discretionary spending, whatever, and that will make the Republicans feel like they've won.
David Wessel, economics editor of the Wall Street Journal and author of the book titled In Fed We Trust. Short break, and we'll be right back. Welcome back. Joining us now from Aspen, Colorado, David Stockman, former Republican congressman from Michigan and budget director during the Reagan administration. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
David, how far can we get with budget cuts alone?
Well, the crisis is so severe that I think we have to recognize that we have an utterly failed fiscal policy, that we have both parties in denial about the huge magnitude of this problem, and that we're really rolling the dice if we think there's indefinite patience in the global bond market for us to continue to issue $6 billion of new debt day in and day out, which is what we're doing now and what we're stuck on. So to tell you the bottom line, the Republican position of no tax increases is absurd. This cannot possibly be addressed in a meaningful, effective way without major tax increases that must begin now and will continue for years or the entire decade into the future. At the same time, the Democrats are way off base in saying that Social Security is off the table, a $700 billion program, that means-tested entitlements are off the table, Medicaid and food stamps and so forth, $600 billion, and that whatever cuts they're talking about are going to be strung out over the next 10 or 15 years. That really is just phony baloney. We need to have a reduction in the amount of red ink that's flowing right now, next month, next quarter, next year. And the only way you can do that is big reform of entitlements, means testing, large revenue increases, and a massive retrenchment of a defense budget that makes no sense at $800 billion in the world that we live in today. This is a obsolete approach to our security, and we need to have huge cutbacks. And it's very disappointing that President Obama has done nothing serious about moving us to a post-Cold War, post, you know, 9/11 defense posture, which we desperately need.
So from your point of view, I gather you would say that neither raising revenues nor cutting spending is likely to be helpful to the economy.
I think we have to face the fact that we've used up our balance sheet. We now have $14 trillion of debt. We just can't keep adding at this rate. And therefore, as we reverse course and begin to cut spending and raise taxes, yes, that will not help the economy. On the other hand, we don't have any choice. We don't have a divine right to an unlimited national credit card. And so we had a 30-year party, a 30-year boom, a lot of it supported by debt increases in both the public and private sector that can't be sustained. So now, as we attempt to begin to deal with the aftermath of this, the choices are not going to be that pleasant. We're going to have austerity, and that will actually slow down the recovery of the economy, but that can't be an excuse for doing nothing, which is what the Keynesians say and what the supply-siders in the Republican Party say. Wait till it gets better, but we can't, outwait this because our balance sheet is too far gone.
All right, so David Wessel is here with me. David, what about Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and the defense budget? David Stockman seems to be saying you can't do anything meaningful without those on the table.
Well, he's right, because that's where the money is. I think we know that the defense budget, Medicare, the program for the elderly, are definitely on the table. The question is how much of a slice they're willing to take out of those budgets. I'm not sure about Medicaid. Social Security, both parties are reluctant to touch now, and we know why that is, because of the power of the myth that Franklin Roosevelt created about the way Social Security is funded and the vote and the politicians' fear of the elderly. But I think that there's I agree with most of what David Stockman said, but there is a view out there that says we can have some appetizers if we give up our main course and dessert. And that view is that we can keep the markets happy. After all, the U.S. is managing to borrow an incredible amount of money at low interest rates now. If we put in place a credible plan that Republicans and Democrats vote for that will reduce the deficit over the next decade, and it has to be credible, and that's a real tough challenge, even if it doesn't cut spending or raise taxes right now when the economy is weak.
David Stockman.
Well, I disagree with that, because I think we've had an illusion of stability in the bond market that's totally unreal. In other words, this market has been entirely manipulated by the Fed through this huge QE2 and then before that QE1 bond buying program and the other central banks of the world. As a matter of fact, in the last 2 years, nearly 100% of this massive issuance of federal debt has been absorbed by either the Fed or other central banks around the world. The problem is that's ending. The Chinese got a rip-roaring inflation. They're not going to be pegging their currency as aggressively. That means they'll be buying less, if any, bonds. We know where Japan is. The Fed is out. QE2 is done, thank heavens. I think it was a disaster. and I don't believe they're going to be allowed to go back in by the dollar currency markets. We'll have a disaster if they do. So now, finally, after years of a false suppressed interest rate on the bond, we're going to have a real two-way market. The mighty bid of the central banks will be gone, and in that market, the price is going to be set by the likes of PIMCO and Pilgrose and others who think with 2.5% inflation over the last 10 years, the 3% yield on the 10-year is totally inadequate to compensate for the risk. So okay. I think interest rates are going to be tested, and we're rolling the dice if in a naked market, as opposed to a Fed-manipulated market, we don't take into account the fact that if they ever start selling off the bond and a panic starts in the bond market, it's Katie bar the door, you can't stop it, interest rates will soar, and we'll then be in a real crisis.
Okay, so let me ask you, David Stockman, if all things were politically possible, what could the administration do to give this economy the very best chance for a strong and quick recovery?
Well, I think Obama could do two things if he were inclined. One, he could call in all the chiefs of the armed forces, the new defense secretary, the whole national security establishment, and say, I want a five-year plan to take down this spending by 20%. By hundreds of billions a year. That can be done, it should be done, and we don't have the luxury of avoiding it. Second, he could say that we can't afford the Bush tax cuts, none of them, not for the rich, not for the somewhat rich, and not for the middle class either. And if anybody tries to extend them after this expiration at the end of 2012, I'll veto it. If he did those two things, massive defense demobilization and an ironclad pledge to veto any extension of the Bush tax cuts, then we would begin to turn the corner on this fiscal disaster and we could dig our way out of the problem.
But
I don't expect him to do that. You know, he is weak. When push comes to shove, the Republicans will roll him again, and we're going to be in one crisis after another. I call it the movable fiscal crisis. It's going to go on for months, years, and perhaps the next decade.
But cutting the armed forces by 20%, taking out those Bush tax cuts, when we're talking about creating jobs, wouldn't it be terrible not only for the military, but for all other employers?
Well, you know, you can say that, but the fact is we're running a $6 billion a day deficit, a $1.5 trillion a year. You can't say that we have an infinite balance sheet and we can just keep piling on the debt. We don't have that luxury. I think it's a dangerous illusion that I blame the Fed for. The low zero interest rates are a signal to politicians that debt can be accumulated indefinitely in unlimited amounts. That is a terrible economic illusion. And the sooner we get to more reasonable interest rates and recognize that we have to pay our bills, the better we're going to be.
Tell me,
if it causes some real economic hardship in the transition.
Tell me what you think Ronald Reagan would do in this situation.
It's pretty hard because today is so different from what existed in 1980. In 1980, we had a clean balance sheet as a nation. Total debt was 160% of GDP. Today, it is 360%, not even in the same universe. I think the circumstances that we face would be so foreign, so alien to anything that Ronald Reagan thought about at the time, that it's impossible to know how he would respond to
that. Do you share the qualms that many people have over the consequences of not raising the debt ceiling?
No, I don't. I think that is the debt ceiling is a red herring. It is the usual propaganda, the August 2nd drop-dead date, usual propaganda out of Treasury and the Wall Street bond dealers. The Wall Street bond dealers, 19 of them, are sitting on a couple hundred billion of inventory of bonds. They're scared to death that there might be some dislocation in the market. They would take losses, but frankly, they've been emitting money now for years and years, buying the bonds one day from the Treasury, selling them back to the Fed the next day. So the fact is we have $200 billion a month of revenue coming in now, even in the current circumstance. The interest on the debt is $20 billion a month. If push comes to shove, they can pay the interest. No default will happen. $60 billion a month is the cost of Social Security. If push comes to shove, they can pay that too. The rest of it has to go then into some kind of prioritization. If we have to cut, if we have to delay paying defense contractors, I say so be it. If we have to delay paying Medicare carriers, insurance companies, and scooter chair manufacturers, I say so be it. We need to force a crisis. We need to force a dislocation in the bond market, drive up interest rates so Congress and the White House finally wake up to the severity of this problem and take meaningful action. What they're talking about in the Biden committee is just a lot of, you know, usual flim-flam and sham. These cuts are not real. They're over 10 years. They can't be enforced. The Congress has 100 ways to get around them. And this is unfortunately the state of play that we're really facing today.
David Stockman, he's former budget director during the Reagan administration, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Alexis, do you want to comment?
Well, I thought it was very interesting, but I think we're talking about two different things here. Let's come back to the discussion we're having. To his credit, Mr. Stockman is trying to think long-term, whatever you agree or disagree about his prescriptions. But in this case, we're talking about a short-range crisis, meaning what are we going to do before August 2nd? And Mr. Stockman is talking about something longer term. This discussion in Washington may have originally started as being a long-term discussion about what do we need to do about deficit and spending, but that's not what we're doing now. We're mixing two different things. One is the debt ceiling has to do with our obligations in the past. He may be right in this concept that it's a red herring to merge the two things, the idea of future deficit reduction with our obligations from the past, but that's already happened. The president has conceded the fact that there will be a linkage between an agreement going forward and our paying our obligations by raising the debt ceiling going forward, at least through 2012.
David Stockman, do you want to comment?
Well, yeah, I agree the two issues are separate. I just don't agree that there's a hard and fast August 2nd deadline. I think we have weeks and weeks, even months, if necessary, and in that period of time, not two or three weeks that we have now, but two or three months, it should be possible for a serious White House and a serious Congress to get down to serious plan to address this deficit problem right now before they raise the debt ceiling again. That's all I'm saying. To simply raise the debt ceiling by $700 or $800 billion, which they're talking about now, tightest through November, that's just kicking the can a very short stroke. We'll be back there in November, and if they do it again, we'll be there over and over and over. So the debt ceiling is a real reminder that our fiscal policy is utterly failed, that we're on an unsustainable track, and they have to come up with a meaningful plan that starts now and extends for the long term. As soon as possible.
Chris Deleza.
Well, I would never fight Mr. Stockman in terms of economic knowledge, but I would say that the politics of this, David Wessel made this point earlier, that we tend to be a deadline-driven government. I always compare it to a college student writing a term paper. You know when it's due when the syllabus comes out. You tend to write it the night before. Like it or not, August 2nd has become what many people believe to be, in the political context, I'm not arguing the economics of this, in the political context, a drop-dead deadline. President Obama, in his press conference last week, in which he was decidedly combative with House Republicans, was asked, is this a real deadline or not? He said, this is a real deadline. There are real consequences to passing this deadline. So he is setting it up and framing it as August 2nd is when this gets decided one way. Well, prior to August 2nd, but by August 2nd, this is when it gets decided. I would just throw one other thing out there, Diane, that I think makes it difficult, the politics of this. The Washington Post did a poll last month in the middle of June. 71% of people said that they thought not raising the debt ceiling would have serious economic consequences, but almost 4 in 10 Republicans said they didn't want the debt ceiling raised under any circumstances. 1 in 3 independents said they didn't want the debt ceiling raised under any circumstances. Obviously, those two thoughts are decidedly contradictory. I think some of that's because people just don't understand the details of economic policy and what this actually means. But it shows you the difficulty if you are a politician looking at those numbers and trying to wend your way through what's a very difficult political landscape.
All right. We're going to take a short break here. And when we come back, David Stockman, I hope you can stay with us for questions from our listeners. We'll take your calls, your email, and your postings on Facebook and your tweets.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives at gatesfoundation.org. By the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. And by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. This is NPR.
As part of our Environmental Outlook series, how the military is going green, using renewable energy to cut costs and improve national security. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. Sad to say, David Stockman did have to leave us. He thanked us for the opportunity to be on now. David Wessel, I know you had some comments you wanted to make.
I think there are two things I want to say about what Mr. Stockman said. The first is, let's be clear, Mr. Stockman thinks we have to create a crisis in the bond market in order for Congress to do the right thing. President Obama and Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner and House Speaker John Boehner and Majority Leader Harry Reid in the Senate think it's their job to avoid just that crisis. And that's the difference, frankly, between being in office and being in Aspen. The second thing is that I think Mr. Stockman made it seem a little too easy what happens if they don't raise the debt ceiling. He said they can pay the interest, they can pay Social Security, and then we'll worry about the rest. Well, you might be on the receiving end of the rest. You might be a defense contractor who has to pay wages. You might be a hospital that's taking care of Medicare and Medicaid people. You might be somebody who's in the middle of building a road that's federally funded. You might be a school system counting on federal funds. It's the government takes in less money every day than it spends, and it has to borrow the difference. If it can't borrow, it's not going to meet all its obligations. That is not a good situation to be in, even if it produces some responsible fiscal policy in the long run.
All right, let's go to Marblehead, Massachusetts. Good morning, Bruce.
Good morning. I'll try to be as brief as possible and wade through the fog and the confusion. I appreciate all the panels' insights, but they don't help me as an American at all any more than the endless polls. The game of chicken will go on being played because that's what politics is all about. Meanwhile, we stand helplessly by and watch it being played. I think it's ironic, and I'd like some comment, although it may be far-fetched, that this is all happening in the Civil War commemorative year. The 1850s were dysfunctional in the government for an irrepressible conflict. And part of it was economic. It wasn't just about slavery and two ways of life. I think we're seeing something of the same thing.
Well, I mean, I think the comparison between slavery, even the economic impact of it, and our current debt ceiling and financial budget crisis is overblown, frankly. That said, yes, I think the caller's frustration is something that is reflected. He said he didn't the endless poll, so I will purposely not cite a poll to cite his frustration. But let me just say it is a feeling that is widely held in the country. It is what is getting people to talk about the idea of a third party candidate in 2012, someone who runs as a problem solver. But Diane, I would say everyone likes the idea of compromise, except when compromise involves cutting or reducing or taking away something that they personally value. And then compromise is of less value. And that's always the problem. The grand compromise is always something people are attracted to. The nitty-gritty that goes into that compromise is where we get into the difficulty.
And here's an email from Lisa on that subject, who says, Major Garrett, who now writes for National Journal, was asked who would be blamed if the deficit was not raised. He said President Obama would be blamed if he continued to refuse to compromise. Lisa goes on to say, I don't get it. As I see it, the president and Democrats have already compromised by coming up with $2 trillion in cuts. I don't see Republicans willing to compromise because they refuse to raise any revenues, which would be their part of the negotiations compromise. Alexis.
Well, in some ways, Lisa is right that the president has already conceded what Democrats would think of as a lot of territory, in that he didn't demand a clean debt ceiling increase, which his predecessors have done before. He conceded that the two ideas would be linked, the idea of deficit reduction going forward to somehow offset whatever the increased borrowing would be to pay past obligations. I think she's heightening our attention to the divisions in the party. So, for instance, the Republicans are very hopeful that this will drive wedges in the Democrats, that they will be upset with any kind of compromises that touch Republican Democratic programs that they're very keen to preserve, Medicare being one, or support programs, etc. And interestingly enough, the whole discussion of taxes and revenue increases has brought Republicans together more than driven them apart. That's a problem politically for the president. His news conference, he hoped, would elevate his discussion, the bully pulpit argument, to the public and give him more clout to argue against what Republicans are interested in doing. In some ways, you could say that news conference brought Republicans more united, more together on the discussion. Because the concept of not raising taxes, the ideological fault line that presents brings Republicans together more cohesively just by the nature of the discussion.
David Wetzel.
So the Republicans who are promoting this view would say now that they were elected to shrink government. And if you don't take an opportunity like this to shrink government, when would you ever do it? And they believe that one of the obstacles to a faster recovery and economic growth is to get government out of the way. They talk a lot about removing the uncertainty about future tax increases. So they feel very strongly that, A, this is what the people elected them to do, and B, that this would make the economy better. It's not the conventional economic textbook view. I'm not saying I agree with it, but I think it's important to remember that it's not all about posturing. They do have some principles here. One of the problems they have, though, if we're really going to lick the deficit by just doing it on the spending side, then you have to do much deeper spending cuts than even they are willing to vote for. And so that's the tension, I think, that they're facing.
And on that point, here's an email from Rich in Raleigh, North Carolina. Really going to what you're saying, David, he asks, what's the difference between taking $1 from the poor through a benefit cut and taking $1 from the rich through a tax increase? From the point of the U.S. Treasury, it's the same dollar, but in Republican economics, the benefit cut is fine, the tax increase a mortal sin. The Ryan Medicare plan is essentially a $6,000 per year tax on seniors.
I think the emailer makes a very good point, that from the viewpoint of the Treasury, a dollar saved and a dollar raised in taxes are the same. And from the viewpoint of a Keynesian economist who's looking at the short-term ups and downs of the economy, they have similar effects. What Republicans are saying, I think, is twofold. One, we cannot raise taxes sufficiently to cover the promises we've made to paid benefits. So if we're ever going to agree to tax increases, we have to make sure that we have some credible restraints on long-term spending for benefits, particularly for health benefits. And the second thing Republicans would say is that tax increases remove the incentive for people to invest and to make money, and that would have a deleterious effect on the economy. That's the argument that they make. They do actually say that a dollar saved in benefit cuts does less harm to the economy than a dollar raised by raising tax rates. I'm not associating myself with that view, but that is what they say.
Alexis.
Well, this discussion underscores why we're not going to get to the mega deficit reduction deal by July 22nd. So these ideological schisms between the two parties are not going to be resolved in terms of our deficit and spending programs for the long term by July 22nd. So let's back up and just say that still is going to be a discussion for future years. And the president's ambition is that will be a discussion post-2012. Mm. There are many Republicans who would like it just as easily to be post-2012. But each side would like to score some political points. That is just the naked truth of Washington right now, that we can't argue it away. So the discussion then in this week and the coming week is what political incentives could each side rally around and find, as Chris was suggesting, just enough votes to move it through the House and the Senate. And then the Republicans who said that they would never vote for a tax increase can then go and campaign that they did not. They voted against it. They opposed it, etc. And so then we could raise the debt ceiling for the 75th time and get past the 2012 election. That is where we're headed.
All right, to Margate, Florida. Good morning, Henry.
Diane, I am in the process of selling everything I own and moving to Australia because I am tired of the hypocrisy of the party that raised the debt limit 8 times during the Bush administration without calling for deficit reduction and the spinelessness of Barack Obama and the Democrats. Now, I lived through 500% interest rate in Sweden. I will not do that again in this country. Okay? Now, a pox on the Democrats and the Republicans for driving me and my children out of our country, because this is what is coming to going to happen to this country. These people do not understand economics. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Well, it's hard to argue with his passion. You know, look, Henry, I think Henry touches on, again, you certainly heard it in his voice, Diane. There is tremendous frustration. You
Absolutely.
Know, I initially thought, well, he's upset with Republicans and they're not compromising. But no, he also is upset with Barack Obama and in his word, not mine, the spinelessness of Democrats. You know, Alexis mentioned that, and she's 100% right, that it's so unlikely that this grand bargain, this big thing, is very likely to happen. Every day that we get closer to whether it's a real deadline or a false deadline, that August 2nd deadline, the less likely it is we get some sort of grand bargain. The one thing I would say is Barack Obama ran in 2008 in large part on getting the government to be able to do big things again. That he was someone uniquely, because of his experiences in life, who could make people who did not want to work together, work together. When he ran, the cynics, and I probably put myself in there, who had seen this political process play out, said it's going to be, you know, there's just such intractable problems in terms of compromise. But he did run on that. And the question is, if you can't get a grand bargain, if you are kicking the can down the road a year, 2 years, does it in some meaningful way undermine Barack Obama's fundamental brand, which is bringing big change and positive change to government, getting government to work for people again? If you have frustrations like Henry just voiced, I think the likely result is a pox on both your houses broadly. But remember, there's only one incumbent president on the ballot in 2012.
Chris is a Washington Post politics blog and managing editor of postpolitics.com, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. And now to Fairport, New York. Good morning, Joyce.
Good morning. I want to add one thing to this. One of the things that concerns me very greatly is I hear people in admiration of the discipline of the Republican Party for staying on message. Well, I think the D word should be dictatorial, because these people were elected to serve the good of the country. When they see that there are real crises, you can go and argue all you want to ideologically, but we're talking about real people with real problems, as the impassioned man said. In terms of the Social Security, people have paid into it all their life with the promises that the government would protect it. Instead, they have willy-nilly taken out of it from whenever they wanted to. There was a time when Clinton left, there was a surplus, and I believe it was Dale Bumpers, but somebody from the South, who urged them to really go and make safe things like Medicare and Social Security. Instead, we had massive tax cuts. And I have one final thing that I want to say. The Republicans have vowed, when we talk about principles of the Republican Party, to oppose anything that Obama says. And yet people want to blame Obama because he didn't bring the country together. You have a Republican Party that is vowing to be sure that will not be done, and exercising a discipline that makes it happen and keeping on message is hurting this country.
David Wessel.
Well, let's see. It's she has a clear point of view, and there's a logic to what she says. I'm less alarmed about the ideological conflict. I believe the ideological conflict actually represents a disagreement among the American people. I don't think it's 90-10 one way or the other. I think people actually disagree about what to happen now. Some of it is based on their preferences. Some of it is based on in economics that may not be very sophisticated. I think the difficulty is that we don't seem to have the leadership in Washington now to say we have to do things that none of us want to do if we're going to move the country forward. And I worry that this focus on deficits and debt reduction is being seen in the country the way this caller and some of the others did, as a sign that both parties and our political elites in general are unable to do what needs to be done to get the economy moving again.
But here's an email from Marielle in Baltimore, who says, when any of us normal folks have a cash flow problem, more debt than income to pay for it, we usually take two approaches. We try and cut expenses, don't go out as much, and we raise income by working longer hours or getting a second job. I don't see how the Republicans can possibly expect to balance the budget without an increase in revenues.
Well, you know, you can argue what they could possibly expect to see. But as David was trying to explain, there's a lot of effort to think about ways to think on the revenue side and not call it a tax. Actually, that's sort of where we are at this point. And as David was suggesting, we're arguing about what the president calls a balanced package to get the debt ceiling raised that, as David was suggesting, is not 50-50. We're talking about a relatively smaller minority of the entire package that is supposed to be on the revenue side. So, you know, the Democrats are going to argue they have come as far as they can come.
All right. Quick question, one word answer. Will the August 2nd deadline be met?
Yes.
Yes.
I don't disagree with David Wessel on the economy.
All right. And that's Chris Saliza of The Washington Post, Alexis Simmendinger of Real Clear Politics, David Wessel of The Wall Street Journal. I hope you're right. I'd like to see this argument over and done with. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, Monique Nazareth, and Sarah Ashworth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Katie June Friesen answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives, transcripts, podcasts, and CD sales. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. And we're on Facebook and Twitter. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.